I'm afraid the selfie moment when you've climbed your summit or been to wherever you go seems to be so important to society these days. And most people aren't carrying cameras anymore, and they're all touchscreen. So unless you have got these clever gloves that seem to work on touchscreens, everyone's taking their gloves off. And 5 minutes on the summit of Vincent or somewhere like that is enough to get frostbite.
Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Sarah Spelsberg, and I'm your host for this edition, Biometric Monitoring in Extreme Environments. Our guests today are Dr. Chris Imre and Dr. Nat Taylor. These are two subject matter experts in monitoring in extreme environments. So Chris is a consultant, vascular and renal transplant surgeon at UHCW NHS Trust Coventry, UK, and is an honorary professor at Warwick Medical School, Exeter University, and Coventry University. He has ongoing altitude research with Caldwell Extreme Everest Research Group, and he is an acknowledged world expert in frostbite and non-freezing cold injuries, and runs the UK Internet Telemedicine Frostbite Service for the British Mountaineering Council. He is an avid global mountaineer. Major Dr. Natalie Taylor is a GP in the British Army and an active member in the Girl Guide movement. Nat is an avid endurance athlete and has competed in the Ice Maiden Challenge. She has reached the South Pole multiple times and holds many records. She has given a very popular TED Talk, Defrosting Your Potential, and I strongly recommend giving it a listen. In this installment, we're going to discuss the nature of extreme environments, scenarios such as research in which monitoring is indicated, the evolving technology for biometric monitoring in extreme environments, and their vision for the future. So Chris and Nat, first of all, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules and away from your patients and adventures to join me on the World Extreme Medicine Podcast, and a big welcome to both of you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. Very kind of you to introduce us so positively.
It's just the truth. It is just the truth. I asked you to be my guest today to discuss biometric monitoring in extreme environments because of your vast extreme medical experience in research and remote environments. And so there are several companies developing devices for physiologic monitoring and AI for data analysis. And so just in a general overview at first, to get us started, what has been your experience with biometric monitoring in extreme environments, good or bad? Nat, I'll send it to you first.
Thanks, Sarah. I think there's a wealth of devices available on the market, and there's a lot of people doing a lot of work trying to develop their own bespoke devices for physiological monitoring in the extreme environment. The biggest challenge at the moment is to work out what you want and what you want to monitor before you even think about the environment. And then once you start looking at the environment, you have to then think about how the cold affects the data, the device, whether the battery lasts, and then also looking at how's the data going to be stored, does it go up onto a cloud, and how can you do all of that in the extreme environments. There's so many different things to think about. I think, first of all, what do you want to collect and why? And then secondly, what impact is the environment going to have on that technology?
And how about you, Chris?
So I'm quite old school. I started doing research a long time ago in extreme environments, and there it was all hardwired and quite complicated to do. The equipment's got lighter and easier to use, and then more recently, the wearable technologies have become much more available. They do transform what you can and can't do, but as Nat was alluding to, you've got to really know what you want to measure and how often you want to measure it. And then there are other things that you don't think about immediately, but also relevant, and that is how you're going to charge your devices, how you're going to download the data, and how you're going to analyze it afterwards. I have to say that Nat is the real expert between the two of us on this particular in this particular area, and she has sort of led the way with some of the stuff she's done in Antarctica in particular. So yes, I was very lucky to team up with Nat and be able to share in some of her expertise.
And that playing off that, like, how do you feel about like how accurate the data is? In the US, we use the term sensitivity and specificity. And how do you feel about the data you get from the different devices and the options for analyzing it?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? The specificity, sensitivity of the information is key, isn't it, to whether you're going to use it or not in the future, and whether you're going to use it to monitor our patients or our expedition members. You've got devices like the GeniActive or Empatica that are medical grade, and they're known to, you know, have really robust systems to make sure that they're accurate. But then you have those wealth devices like the Garmin and the Oura Ring that are used en masse. Although they don't have that medical sensitivity specificity, we don't know what their algorithms are. They're not publicly available. So it's really hard to identify how accurate they are. But when it comes to those big corporate devices, the Garmin and the Oura, maybe the Polar Verity Sense, I would say that it's about then recognizing that pattern of change. If people are wearing them constantly, they can then see that delta to see if they're getting sick or improving in performance.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Chris, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I think Nat sort of alluded to the key point here, and that is that some of these things are really good at measuring trends, and the advantage is you've got multiple measurements, often as frequently as once a second, and so you can see trends very nicely. The absolute number may not be quite as accurate, but in some ways that's not so important in this situation. Something else that was very noticeable that I think comes into this is how you interact with the device itself. Most of the devices that you see widely in use amongst the sporting public, if you like, have some sort of feedback for the individual so they can interact and see what their pulse is or how they're performing. Things that we used we were blind to. And that means that you don't really get any feedback on how you're getting on in the same way. And that over a period of time on such as this sort of extended travel on the ice for nearly 50 days means that you're not quite as engaged in what you're doing. It's just there observing rather than feeding back to you.
That's interesting. That's the real-time nature of the data, right? Are we getting it immediate feedback, or do we get home and have a giant folder of data that we need to then try to find time to analyze as we're acclimatizing back into our daily life? Did you have any that you were trying to do real-time, or was it mostly the observership monitoring devices?
So there was access to devices. Sorry, yeah. So we did have one device, the Oura Ring. It's got quite a good storage capability onto a phone app. So you could wear it before you go to bed, you sleep with the ring on, and then in the morning you can look at, you can sync the data on the ring to your phone, and you can see it gives you a sleep rating, tells you if you should or shouldn't sleep more. And so that the participants could see that data. And so you probably got better engagement with that, whereas the other devices they were blind to, they didn't know, they just had to wear them.
And then another thing to that is if they're getting real time, is there a Hawthorne effect? Are they like actively trying to do things differently, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really key, isn't it, is when it comes to the research element of wearables, whereas when we're looking at real-time using for our patients and our expedition colleagues or performance in athletes, we want that effect, don't we? We want them to realise that actually if their sleep wasn't very good, they should probably sleep better, because that's got a better knock-on effect either for stress levels, immunity, or for performance. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is a challenge within the research domain.
Yes. Chris, did you find your sleep changed at all?
Well, I mean, I was going to say that there is also a compounding effect there. One of the things we were doing was looking at sleep and filling in questionnaires. And it's very difficult if you fill the questionnaire in after you've looked at the results on how you allegedly slept than before. So it can lead you in your responses as to how you sleep. So if the device says you slept badly, I think that will probably interact with the way you respond to the questionnaire. So it's really important how you time what you're going to measure.
Sure, how they felt about how they slept versus how they actually slept. Yeah. We used the Oura Ring to, we used it to monitor Dottori in the Project Neptune 100 with him underwater. So he wore that and I had that data daily.
And so you're also filtering through that mass of data.
Yes. Yes.
Did you find that the sleep data that you got off the Oura Ring was helpful to, for the individual, or you didn't find it informed you greatly?
I would say that it definitely correlated with how he felt because we checked in and it correlated with how he felt. He was aware of how, you know, oh, I didn't sleep well. Let's see what it says. And oh, yep, nope, I didn't sleep well. And so I would say it correlated with how he felt he slept. Definitely interesting with him underwater, just as an aside, his REM sleep and deep sleep doubled the entire time he was underwater compared to before. And it went back to normal about maybe, I think, 2 weeks after coming back to the surface.
So that'll be interesting to see compared to ours, because we had 24-hour daylight. Yeah. And one of our research colleagues, he's a bit of a science and a mathematician genius, shall we say, and he's found a way of accessing the raw data for the for the Oura. So we're going to compare that with the Genie Active, and it might be interesting after we've done this maybe to touch base to see if we can compare your data too.
I would love that, and I would also love to know how to get that raw data. I don't know if I have it or not. I have some raw data. What can we do? So what can we do with this data? Like, how does this data change how healthcare is delivered, or how we monitor soldiers in extreme environments, or athletes in extreme environments? What can we do with this data, Chris?
I was reflecting. One of the biggest changes that has occurred in the way we look after surgical patients in the last 15, 20 years is the use of the early warning system. So measuring pulse rate, blood pressure, and SATs, for instance, and that gives you often 6 hours head start on someone becoming unwell, maybe becoming septic or whatever. And just that simple scoring system was useful, but to have that in real time, to have a continuous monitoring of that, which is essentially what we're getting information about the way an individual is performing in an environment, either doing well or not so well. So that's the big change. We've moved from it being a hospital-based setting to something that can now be moved into the community, or now in this situation into an extreme environment. And I think Nat can probably talk to this more than I can, but if you look at some of the ways in which the military are keeping an eye on individuals in very extreme, perhaps heat-based environments, it's remarkable. Nat, do you want to talk to that?
Yeah, certainly. So there's quite a lot of collaboration between the US military and the British military with some of my other collaborators that I'm with, looking at heat illness in the British military. We've got quite a mature device now with quite a good algorithm that can advise commanders on up to like 100 of their people at one time if they're wearing this device. If they're getting too hot, as we know, we get these people to work incredibly hard, build up lots of internal heat, and exertional heat injury unfortunately does cause loss of life unnecessarily during training. So if we can reduce that, we've got a wearable technology to help us there. And then if you then reflect, as Chris was saying, in the community, we're now doing some work looking at movement, and if patients are moving less in the community after they've been discharged from an acute admission in hospital, is that an indication of potential readmission to hospital? And actually, could an early intervention from a hospital team going into the community to identify if that patient needs something that they could have at home rather than going back to hospital? Because we know it's all about cost and also just reducing morbidity and mortality. We don't want people in hospital any longer than we need to. And actually, we've now got the technology that can do this, but what we need to really look at is the data security and the safety and how we implement it. Because the biggest thing is, we can have an amazing device, but you need your patients to wear it, don't you?
Mm-hmm. You need them to wear it for sure. And have you encountered any privacy issues with the data?
Not on our end from Inspire, because we were doing a joint civilian military expedition. There's quite a lot of rules when it comes to doing research on military personnel, and so we have quite a strict data policy anyway. So we had to get all that done through ethics. But it's not a big hurdle that you can, it's not a big hurdle, it's easily overcome.
Yes, Chris?
So one of the things that we perhaps haven't looked at in detail is access to the internet. So if you listen to what Nat's just been saying about monitoring the military, for instance, in the field, they've usually got internet access and able to use their devices telemetrically. So they're able to monitor individuals going about their business. Because we had no internet access for quite large chunks of our time, we weren't able to upload this data. So we couldn't have been looked at remotely by an outside team, but we are looking at it retrospectively to see what changes. So again, if you're thinking about taking devices into a very remote environment, you need to think about what sort of internet coverage or how you're going to download that data if you want to look at it in real time. Retrospectively, that's another matter. That's just storage issues.
And so then, other than like weather and climate effects on the hardware itself, because that can be a whole set of hurdles, any differences that you would foresee in trying to monitor someone in Antarctica as you did in a cave or climbing Everest or in an undersea habitat or like the space station? What differences do you see? Do you want to start with that, Nat?
So I think when it comes to the environment, as Chris has alluded to, certain devices now, you can just get the data to Bluetooth connect or NFC connect between the device and your phone or a tablet. So you don't need internet and you can use an application to see all of that data. But then that's the individual seeing the data. So how is that getting interpreted? Have you got a medical person next to them, or is there an algorithm that's going to explain to them what that means? So that can be done in any location. With regard to kind of if you were going into space or going down into a cave or the deep sea or up Everest, and you've already talked about the hardware parts, it's mainly about then the storage and the stability of the devices. One of the things that we've been looking at in Inspire is, because we had 9 participants over 47 days of data collection, how many data points were lost? So how much of that data is dropped? Because that's then the second consideration, isn't it? Is we talk about sensitivity and specificity, but actually if we've lost half of the data, then there's no sensitivity or specificity, is there?
No. And what do you see as the challenges in these varying environments, Chris?
I think Nat's covered most of them. The other thing to think about also is how to keep these devices charged. They're all electronically based, and if they're very power hungry and require a lot of storage space for any data they're saving, then these are the limiting factors. I mean, we're lucky with in some ways in going on the Antarctic trip because we've got 24-hour sunlight. And it's possible to charge most of these things with with portable solar panels, setting them up in the tent overnight, and we're able to keep on top of most of the devices. But even then, there is a limit to what you can do in that time scale, and you then have to prioritize which devices you think are more important. So that's an issue. You also said, what's going to happen in the future? I mean, I think one of the possibilities will be implanted devices. If you think about where we're going in medicine in general, implanted devices, particularly for the ECG monitoring and things, are becoming the norm for certain sorts of conditions. And I suspect the interface between the device and the individual in these harsh environments, you may well find that having a subcutaneous device would be advantageous. Obviously, there are disadvantages about putting it in there and taking it out and so forth and so on, but they're probably more robust, in fact, than this. We, at one point, when we started, we were wearing, I think it was 4 or 5 devices in different places, arms, wrists, fingers, etc., and we were quite heavily laden down, and this was gradually reduced until we got to the ones that we thought would work and were most valuable. And we ended up 3 or so that we were keeping. So, yeah, I think that will be, I think implanting devices may well be the future. I don't know. And that's, as I say, the real whiz on this. So she'll tell us where the future is, really.
Well, there are already implantable devices that are just going through, is it FDA, the approval system within the states.
FDA.
Yeah, it is FDA, there we are. So stateside, there are devices already that have gone through porcine trials that can last for up to kind of a year before they get absorbed by the body. And they're detecting some fascinating things, like various, the electrolytes within your body. I've been in discussion with them whether they could do serum cortisol as well, because we know how interesting our stress levels are and how important that could be if we were looking at optimizing performance and also identifying ill health. So that technology exists at the moment. It's just, I think we've already alluded to, like, what are you going to test? And we talk about biomarkers, and the other part of Inspire 22 is looking at various biomarkers for activation of brown fat and other kind of metabolic or metabolites. But we still don't know if there is that kind of magic bullet, isn't there, of a biomarker that goes up at the beginning of disease. It's an earlier indicator than lactate. We've looked at NGAL in the past, and if we can find those biomarkers, we do have the technology now that we could then put them into an implantable device that could be used remotely.
That is fascinating. So on your trip, did you draw blood?
No.
Okay. I know I had challenges drawing, like scuba diving down and drawing blood and getting the samples safely. I can't imagine trying to do that in Antarctica.
No, we just drew saliva and urine from each other.
Okay.
So, I mean, we had a fairly complex set of studies in the UK before we left, and when we got back, we then moved from doing just those experiments to doing testing in South America. And then we did do some blood draws in Antarctica, but this was not during the expedition itself. The expedition, as Nat said, we were doing urine, saliva and hair sampling, and then various anthropomorphometric studies, weight, skin fold thickness and so on, which was a joy every 5 days to strip off and be measured in minus whatever it was at the time, and stand in a trench that had been dug in the within the vestibule of the tent to try to stand vertical on the scales. Yes, there were one or two members of the team that were very keen on digging deep trenches in. So quite a lot of research on the ice, but blood draws, we drew the line at trying to basically get centrifuges working.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And so I have had analog and electronic gear unable to perform in extreme environments, like even a well-known and tested tourniquet freezing because of where I had it on in my backpack and breaking under stress. And the iPhone malfunctions when it's too cold or too hot. And so what has been your experience like testing these different technologies across these heterogeneous environments, such as polar and high altitude and you mentioned South America?
Yeah, so I was super lucky to be on an expedition up Broad Peak the summer prior to Antarctica, and we were doing research there as well. So from a high altitude perspective, the devices performed well, and the challenges were more so in Antarctica because of the extreme cold. But interestingly, using a centrifuge off poor power supply in small towns in Pakistan wasn't possible. We had to use our massive battery pack to use the centrifuge, which I thought was fascinating. So that was then like another reason why I was like, we're not taking a centrifuge to Antarctica, because the battery we'd have had to pull to actually power the centrifuge, because it wouldn't have worked off no matter how big a solar panel we had, is really useful to know. But when it comes to the wearable devices, I think the extreme part, what I was most surprised by and pleased with, was how well all the devices charged when they are, because of the kind of effect of the tent in Antarctica. It's actually quite warm when you put the device next to the tent material when it's in the sun. So everything can stay warm. So the battery pack's warm, the device is warm, so then they charge really nicely. And it's interesting what you say about the iPhones. Definitely Android is better in the cold.
Android is better in the cold. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree with that. I took an iPhone and it would bleed power very quickly. I think the technology, one of the things I would say, having done all sorts of quite complicated tests in all sorts of challenging environments, is you need them to be robust and work well in less hostile environment and gradually up your game. So, for instance, on Extreme Everest, everything had to work in the UK, and then you gradually worked up in altitude until finally you're doing blood draws at 8,400 meters from femoral arteries and things. But it's an incremental learning process rather than attempting to get it to work for the first time in the most hostile environment where it really isn't going to work. And there's an attrition to that, and you just accept that not everything does work. And we'll be going through looking for missing data in the Inspire 22 stuff, and we'll have to see where the missing data is and how serious it is in terms of how we interpret it.
And I think Chris hasn't mentioned this before, but he's told me the story several times, and I think it's fascinating that how technology has developed and how reliant we are now on our phones. But Chris will articulate much better, but he's noticed that we perhaps get more frostbite now because people are trying to touch the screen of their phone instead of a normal camera.
Note to North Face and Patagonia, you need to make like something on the big winter gloves that'll do that. That is interesting. Yeah. So you saw more frostbite, Chris.
Well, definitely. I mean, I'm afraid the selfie moment when you've climbed your summit or been to wherever you go seems to be so important to society these days. And most people aren't carrying cameras anymore, and they're all touchscreen. So unless you have got these clever gloves that seem to work on touchscreens, everyone's taking their gloves off. And 5 minutes on the summit of Vincent or somewhere like that is enough to get frostbite. And you've got to be super aware of this. We were lucky on our trip to the South Pole. We had very few injuries, but I think there was an awareness, we're all very aware of protecting each other and protecting ourselves, and you can mitigate it. But iPhones and touching for long periods of time is a no-no. You're absolutely right. Now, that's a crucial message to get through.
So with extreme athletes, elite athletes, do these kinds of tests and these kinds of monitorings change the game at all for like heart rate zone training, or even in the military also? Just
I think if we can employ this correctly. Sorry, Chris, go on.
Well, I was going to actually just say, do you know what? The person you need to ask this question to is Nat. She is an extreme endurance athlete. And I'm really not going to say anything, except you've got exactly the right person to ask the questions of. Nat, over to you.
I think Chris is alluding to the fact that I do quite a bit of running. But if you ask me about nutrition, I'll tell you what you should do. But I fuel on a pack of biscuits a day. So do as I say, not as I do. Although I am looking at being a bit more scientific this year. I think on a serious note, looking at our soldiers, it could be a complete game changer if we can find the device that they're going to use and engage with. You look at during the COVID outbreak, how people were joining Strava groups and doing virtual training together. It had a really positive impact, didn't it? Because there was a platform where people could be accountable for their physical activity. We know how important sleep is on our performance, and if people respond well to wearing a ring at night that tells them how well they slept the night before, and some of them, our team members are quite competitive by the nature of who we recruited into the expedition, and so they would like see who could get the best sleep score, so they were really keen to get to bed and get some good sleep because they wanted to win. And if we can do that for our athletes, amazing, and for our soldiers. But then equally, if we're going to do better heart rate zones and stuff, it's again getting a device that they wear consistently, because for example, the Garmin's heart rate is great when we're sitting at rest, but as soon as it gets hot and sweaty, which is what happens when you do physical activity, mm-hmm. the technology that it uses to pick up a heart rate is less accurate. So we either have to wear it regularly and really tight, or we have to look at some of the medical grade devices and use those instead.
And what do you think about like the Apple Watch? Because just from a monitoring standpoint, it once alerted me that I had, had a run of an irregular heartbeat in an airplane, and it actually notified all of us when our dad fell and didn't get up. And we got this notification like, hey, there's been a fall, EMS has already been called to his location. And I just thought, gosh, I set this up thinking, oh, this is cool, never thinking that we would really need it. And so what do you think about those sort of off the shelf things that people wear on their own? And
I think it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because, like you say, you've been given a notification when you've been told you've got an irregular heart rate, and maybe, we've got the knowledge. We can put our hand on our pulse and see if it is or isn't irregular. And there's a lot of worried well people that come into, our clinics as primary care. My Apple Watch has told me I need to come and see a doctor. I'm like, yeah, you're a soldier and you have a heart rate of 45. That's normal for you because you're so fit. I don't think you've got first degree heart block. But of course, then it's that putting it into context. And the Apple Watch can't do that yet. I'm sure with time these things will be good, but it's just that double-edged sword. You don't want the worried well, but equally, to help someone like your dad, that was amazing.
I
How about you, Chris? Do you wear any of these?
well, I was just thinking, I was driving down the road about 3 weeks ago when a car suddenly swerved and hit me and wrote my car off. The guy was had the window open, and a wasp flew in and landed on his leg, and he was busy trying to swat the wasp off his leg when he hit me. Anyway, the airbag went off and the car spun round and everything was sort of stopped. And then my phone said, "You appear to have been in a car crash," and wanted to phone the 999. And I'm thinking, do you know what? I don't need to be told that. It's clear this has happened. But yes, the technology is good. I guess I could have just about reached out and touched it, and the police would arrive. But anyway, so yeah, the technology is good. It even knows when you've had a car crash.
Wow. Are you okay? I'm sorry about that.
Fine. No. I was more shocked that this car just swerved and hit me. You're driving quite innocently down the road and you're thinking, this isn't how it's supposed to end.
No, a
You're
bee.
very lucky. Wow.
All because
Anyway.
now, would it have called 999 if you didn't say anything to it? Like, would it have
I think so.
automatically
I
called
think
it if you were
I
unconscious?
To be honest, I can't remember the exact thing. I was a little shaken at the time, but
Sure.
I think if I'd done nothing, it would have called help, and it would have presumably known my GPS location as well. So it is pretty impressive.
And so what do both of you see, like 2024, 2034, what do you see for the availability, commercialization, and accessibility of these advanced monitoring units?
I think you can divide it into a whole load of different systems, can't you? I think that the device is going to get smaller, the battery lives will get longer, the connectivity and usefulness will improve. The algorithms that interpret the data will get more sophisticated. So I guess what I'm saying is more of the same. I think there are quite a few, I would call them dud devices out there. They're actually quite difficult to use and don't work very well. And commercially, they're not going to do very well. We did talk about the devices becoming implanted. I don't think that'll be widespread, to be honest, but I may be wrong. What else? I think we'll have much better data coming through this, and AI will probably be able to tell us much more about the health of the people that engage. Maybe there'll be sort of subscription monitoring of your vitals if you want it. I don't know. Those are a few of the thoughts from me. Smaller, longer lasting, and better information coming out of it, and probably more going into remoter areas. But I don't know. Now, I don't know what you think. As I say, you're the expert. I always get in first because I can sound a bit more as though I know what I'm talking about, but then you nail it.
That's so kind, but I don't feel like it. I think the word availability and accessibility, I think for me, just hit home there of the technology exists, but it's not cheap. And I think perhaps, and sorry to be a bit negative, but I think perhaps those that need it most like the remote locations are often poorer locations. And so do they, will we as a community like provide that care, the ability to provide better care to people, but there we then would have to put in internet, make sure they've got better access to electricity to power these devices, and we could then actually improve the healthcare of people in remote locations. That is possible, but of course we would need some finance for that. I completely agree with Chris that I think the implantables will be available, but they'd probably be for niche things like those going to NASA, maybe for some extreme activity type and remote places. But I think the way that technology is going to improve our lives in the future will be, as Chris alluded to, better battery life, smaller devices. But for us, I think as well, it's that how we're going to use it. For the NHS, for our National Health Service, we just need a combined approach and work together to have better access.
And even just like post-op patients. So surgeons could send a post-op patient home with a wearable that'll advise them if their heart rate's going too fast or their oxygen's dropping. And one of the fire departments near one of the hospitals where I work, they're putting devices on their firefighters on extreme calls. And then the battalion chief can monitor like all of them on an iPad. And just see, they're testing it out for a company, but they can just see like how much stress are they under, who's maybe in danger, who's wearing out. And I just think it's so exciting. And I'm so grateful for people like both of you who are pushing the limits on this technology and really testing it and trying to see what we can do with it.
We had a really interesting conversation at the end of our expedition. We got substantial sponsorship from a number of internet experts who make a lot of money from their devices, and a number of them came with their own devices that their companies built, and each one thought their device was going to be the best thing since sliced bread. But the challenge was not so much what the device could do, but how it interfaced. And I think that's probably how easy it was to charge up and use. And I think that's something that possibly has been forgotten as people develop the technologies. And it's actually how do you get older, frailer people able to use the device? How do you use it in a more real setting? And having a lot of money, it isn't necessarily spending an awful lot of money on a device that you can't use isn't super helpful. So it was interesting them reflecting on what they would want to see from their devices in future. So it was quite a learning experience for them, I think.
Mm-hmm. And now, if you could just take one wearable on an expedition with you to monitor how you were doing, which one would you choose?
So I think if it was for research and I wanted to get like the most out of my research, hands down Genie Active, because it's a fire and forget. You put it on your wrist, it's a three-way accelerometer, there's proven algorithms. Research, yes, I would use that. It gives you loads of data points and you've got lots of exploit at the end of it if you're collecting like body weight and nutrition data and all that sort of stuff. That one. For myself, if I was like wanting to be a bit of a geek and be more tech savvy, I would probably go for the Garmin that I've got on my wrist, the Fenix 6S, because it's solar charged as well, so it's battery life over 24 hours anyway. When recording, it gets my heart rate, it tells me what recovery I should be doing and that sort of thing. And I think for me, it would be really interesting to use that with my own like perception of my fitness and stuff to train with. So I would go down for my Garmin. There are cheaper ones available called a Koru, but I've never tried it. Just as good, apparently, but that's what I go for.
Nice. How about you, Chris?
I like the simplicity of the Oura Ring, but I am worried about the quality of the data and if Oura were prepared to put it under rather more scrutiny and get it up to standard. I think that's a super easy thing to wear, and that being quite simple, not as tech savvy as many of the guys on the trip, I think the simplicity of that device I liked. So I like that, but I'm really quite uncertain about the data. I absolutely endorse Matt's comments about the Genie Active, which seems to just, it just keeps going in the background. You don't worry about it. You don't even take it off your wrist for, you know, a month at a time. You can't ask for a simpler device than that.
That would have been great. That would have been great to know about 6 months ago. And so do you have any other thoughts before I get on to my the question I ask each guest at the end of the podcast? Do you all have any other thoughts about what are you most excited in the research? And like, yes, Nat.
Mine would be a plea to anybody that's listening, actually. So if they're thinking about doing research in the extreme environment, or they're just going to an extreme environment, that wearables have a great ability to collect data, but we don't know how accurate they are. So please do think about, when you're writing a research protocol, if you're going to add in a wearable, think about what is it going to add to the protocol, but also how can it complement the other things you're collecting? Because I think now we need to start being savvy with the research that we do in the extreme environment, because we've got this technology. We can deliver so much more, but we just need to have a really good think about it, because I think we can get some really amazing answers to questions that, you know, Chris did on the Caldwell Everest expedition. Like, we could answer those questions and maybe better now, because we've got this access to data that we could just couldn't do 20 years ago.
Oh, that's so exciting. How about you, Chris? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think Nat makes some really good points there. I mean, I think that you've got to ask really good questions. You've got to ask whether or not the way in which you're going to monitor or get data off people, whether it's going to answer the questions. There's too much thoughtless data collection, just collecting the data because you can. It doesn't necessarily take you forward. So ask the good question, and then ask what's the best way of measuring that. And if you've got a wearable technology that will do it, then I think you're in a strong position. But you're looking usually with them for trends rather than absolute numbers. And so your data is stronger in some ways because you've got more data points, but it's weaker because you're not. It's not as accurate if you compare a pulse ox with ABGs. Design your experiment carefully, I think, is what I'd say. And the other thing is, don't overcomplicate it. You can do things that are too complicated in environments. You have to be able to keep moving. And we set ourselves on this particular expedition a target of really doing research every 5 days. We do a little bit every day, but significant research every 5 days, and putting aside a bit of time to do that, but not slowing up the expedition. You have a limited amount of time, food, and fuel, and you've got to keep moving. And if you don't move forwards because you're doing so much, in theory, great research, you won't get to the end. So it mustn't interfere with the safety of travel in whatever environment you're talking about.
Our mantra was safety, South Pole science.
Nice. And Nat, do you know of any wearables that would provide meaningful data in somebody who's submerged in an aquatic environment and going to maybe 100 feet, 80 feet?
I don't know that. That's not my area of expertise. Yeah. But the people I collaborate with in the US, the ones that are doing the implantables, I'm pretty sure that device would be great. So I could totally connect you. If you're going to do another submerging thing, let me know.
Yes, perfect. Yes, I need that introduction. And now, Chris, we have, you know, young medics, young doctors, people who are looking at your career. You've been on 6 summits, you've been on volcanoes and climbed cliffs, and they're looking and saying, I want to have that guy's career. How do I do that? And I know you and I touched on this a little bit offline, but what advice would you have for a young medic who thinks, I want to get there? How do I start?
That's a really good question, because looking back, I couldn't claim to have planned much of what I did. What I did have as a teenager was a real enthusiasm to being in the mountains. I loved my climbing. And everything I did, every decision I made, I couldn't help but think, is there a climbing option there? At a fairly early stage, I also worked out the research for me got me the opportunity to get out on these trips. I could usually get some funding, and I could often get study leave. And if I published papers as I went along, you come back and look at the guys at work and they say, you've published what? And we talk about it as work rather than play. But to me, it's play. You know, I've spent my entire life doing what I love doing, what I wanted to do as a teenager. And I can't believe that, you know, that where I've been and what I've been able to do. So be competent at your job, be enthusiastic, take opportunities, and also be really good in the environment you want to practice in. The worry I've got is we go on a lot of these expedition medicine courses, and there's an awful lot of concern about how to practice safe medicine in these environments, and I'm not disagreeing with that. But if you're not competent in that environment, if you can't travel safely, climb big mountains, abseil safely, then you're a liability rather than an asset. And make yourself an asset and you'll get more invites.
And the same question for you, Nat. How, if you had advice for a young medic, I mean, going into the military is a really good way to get some extreme and remote experience oftentimes. But if you had advice for a young medic who says, wow, look at her career. She's been to the South Pole twice. She's done all these things. I want to be her. What advice would you give them?
Think hard. as Chris says, you know, we've had a great time, and hopefully I've still got many years left of adventuring and fun to be had. But there are, as Chris, what Chris hasn't told you is there's so many weddings, family events that you just don't attend because the amount of time that you have to put in around your normal work day to make these things happen is not to be sniffed at. The hardest part of an expedition is getting to the start line, particularly then when you throw in research at the same time. If you're like the research lead, that's a lot of extra work to get done. But what I would say is echo what Chris says, and it's what I say to everybody that asks me, I want to do this. Get good in the environment you want to go in and be happy as a person, because you've got to do some hard clinical skills, potentially quite scary. You know, when I was on Broad Peak, I had to get some people down with AMS. So you're abseiling from like 7,000 meters with somebody that doesn't really know what they're doing, who's twice the size of you. So it doesn't matter how good your medicine is if you're not confident putting on an abseil. So get comfortable where you are, and then the rest of it. The medicine's easy. You've become a doctor already. The medicine's easy. Get the other bits right first.
That's great advice. That is great advice. Any other parting words of wisdom for our listeners?
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. So proud of both of you.
Thank you so much for inviting us, Sarah. I mean, Nat and I had an amazing time, and we will have memories that we'll carry with us the rest of our life. We hope the science will be good, but most importantly, we had a really good time.
What an incredible adventure, and just not a place where most people get to stand. And just, I'm just so happy for both of you and proud of both of you. And you've had incredible careers. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us. Hopefully we've inspired some people that research is really cool.
Gets you to amazing places.
Yes, it does.
And gets you to amazing places. Yeah.
Yes. So thank you again to everyone listening. I'm Dr. Sarah Spelsberg, and it is my pleasure to share these extreme medicine adventures and technological advances with you. If you are listening with us, you too are an extreme medic, and we welcome you to the World Extreme Medicine family. Stay safe out there, and always keep pushing your boundaries.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.